First of all, I wanted to talk a little bit about as to how to model, how to write in a circuit Bell measurements. Now, conventions in a circuit. When I write quantum circuits, the line without saying anything. So when I write a line for a channel for a quantum line here in the circuit, if I write nothing on the left, it means that it's prepared on the zero of the computational basis. So pick a basis for your qubits. And that means that the initial state is zero. So the preparation state is typical. The preparation stage is typically included in the circuit. If you want to start with something different, you have to put there the gates that make the state that you want. Make sense? By default, when we write circuits, if nothing else is said, if you see lines, it means you start at the zero of the computational basis. Okay? Beginning with that. Now, there's something that we haven't of all the basic circuit components that I've given you, we haven't talked about Bell measurements yet. So how do you perform Bell measurements? So critically, you don't perform Bell measurements by doing non-local measurements. If you are supposed to perform a Bell measurement, you can decompose the Bell measurement in the NN measurements on the individual channels, okay? So what I'm telling you is that this circuit is equal to that. I mean, I notate, again, if I write a measurement apparatus here without anything else, it means PVMs in the computational basis. All right, so you measure either the state zero or the state one, whatever you call those, okay? And if it's a different measurement, I specify. So a Bell measurement is equal to this. It's equal to take the state, of course, which is of two qubits coming in, then perform a C0 and then a Hadamard on the control qubit. And then perform two projective measurements on the computational basis. How do I see that? Well, it's easy to see. I have at the end, hopefully, and if not, it will be Wednesday. I will show you with the computers that the algebra works. I'm not gonna do matrix products here. But if you act, I'm doing here the inverse operation. So here we do first the C0 and then the Hadamard, right, on A. I'm doing the opposite here, so you see, there's an entangling gate. You can tell that if I apply the Hadamard on A and then the C0 gate on the computational basis, I obtain maximally entangled states, okay? So there's an entangling gate. Goes from the computation, from separable states in the computational basis to maximal entangled states in the computational basis. Make sense? Okay. So now it's easy to see that the inverse of that map that I wrote here will actually do the opposite. Take you from the Bell state to the computational basis. So if you have Bell states here, if you want to measure if you had Bell state here, so you put this measurement apparatus all together, and then you obtain a zero on the A, a zero on the B. Well, that means I had a 5+. Make sense, everybody? Yeah, question?
Did you say Hadamard and then a C0?
Well, C0 and a Hadamard.
Does it?
This is the inverse, because it's easier to do. Here is first a Hadamard, then a C0. And then I invert it. And now I do a C0 first, then a Hadamard. Right? This is because this is also an interesting thing. This is an entangling gate, and this is a disentangling gate. Make sense, everybody? So that's how you do Bell measurements in a circuit. So you don't need more resources to do Bell measurements than just gates and measurement apparatuses on the individual channels. Make sense? All right. So I have two things to discuss before showing or talking about Grover's algorithm. I have to write, as an example, a circuit for teleportation, either in the tutorial yesterday, because you had one yesterday, apparently, right?
Yeah.
And or the tutorial today, you're going to do dense coding. Have you done it already? Okay, so dense coding is kind of the opposite of teleportation. So there's a circuit. Let's build a circuit for teleportation. Let's first talk about the resources we have. The resources we have are the following. So you have three qubits. They're gonna be, two of them are gonna be in an entangled state. Actually, this is the opposite sign that would be. Yeah, that's right. Two of them are gonna be in an entangled. Well, at the beginning, I start again. Here is all zeros. I'm gonna have three quantum channels, three qubit channels, and two classical channels, two one bit channel. Total of 2 bits. Okay, those are my resources. Make sense? And now what do we do? The first stage, let me write here, stage one, preparation. Remember that in a circuit, you start at zero by default. So whatever state you want to implement has to be implemented by preparation on the circuit, okay? So for the first channel, I just write this side here. This is whatever unitary takes your original qubit in the zero in the computational basis to the state that you want to teleport, okay? I don't care about that. That's the state that you want to send to over to B. Make sense? All right, then next, I need to create a maximally entangled state between one of the qubits of Alice and Bob. Well, that is the entangling gate, right? First the Hadamard, then the C0. Make sense? So in here, at this stage, right, after stage one, I am left with a state A that I want to teleport, psi that I want to teleport, and then an entangled, maximum entangled pressure between Alice and Bob. Make sense? All right, so now we do. Remember what Alice has to do. Alice has to perform a Bell measurement on the state that C wants to teleport and the other state that is maximum entangled with Bob, right? So let's do a Bell measurement. A Bell measurement is a disentangling gate. And then I'm gonna offset this one a bit. And then a measurement. And I do nothing here. Now, the result, the Hadamard, I forgot the Hadamard, sorry. Okay. So this, again, is this box Bell measurement that I have here. So Alice carries out a Bell measurement on the state that she wants to teleport and the state that is maximally entangled with it, with Bob, with the state of Bob. Make sense? Now, of course, these classical measurements will give, these measurements will give you classical information, one bit each. So say I call it CZ because this could be, for example, measuring in the Z basis, and this could be measuring the X basis, for example, I don't care. So I have these measurements. So this one, it doesn't really matter, right? This one gives one bit of classical information to the CZ line. And this one is one bit of classical information to the CX line. All right, so now, with that information is transmitted to Bob, and Bob knows what unitary to perform in order to recover the state. So Bob knows that if the result of the measurement is 0, 0, then do nothing. Remember, 0, 0 means that it was the 5+, okay? So that was do nothing. 0, 1 means apply X. By the way, in quantum info, oftentimes the Pauli matrices are abbreviated by X hat. Not a notation I love, I don't use it much, but it's super common, so let's do it like that. Make sense? You just do X hat, Y hat, Z hat. Then apply Z. And if it's 1, 1, apply minus IY, or what is the same, Z and X, right? Now you see why I call one channel CZ and CX, because one tells you if there's one bit on the X channel, then you apply an X. If there's one bit on the C on the Z channel, you apply a Z. Make sense? That's what explains the names. All right, so now what we do is we do the following. So this information goes here. And it's a control, you see, a classically controlled X operation. That means in the circuit that if there's a 1 in the classical channel X, do an X operation. Now, if there is a 1, this is controlled by this, if there is a 1 in the set channel, then do a set operation. Okay, that's the full circuit, because after that we know that you have here psi. That's not an operation, that's the result. So let me just remove that. Agreed, everybody? So here, the quantum circuit for quantum teleportation. Any protocol in quantum information, you can write, at least in finite dimensions, you can write as a circuit like that. Does that make sense? So you can talk about the notion of circuit complexity, which is how many gates, what is optimizing and getting the minimum number of gates that you need in order to implement a circuit like that. And what do you call your basic gates? Well, you have to make a decision. What is your basic set of gates? What do you consider easy to implement? Make sense? When you study complexity, there's a lot of arbitrary choices. One of them is, what do I call easy gates? All right? And then second is, what measure of distance do I implement on that? But in finite dimensions, it's relatively easy to do one. You can talk about the circuit complexity, the depth of the circuit. How many gates do you need? But of course, then the choice is, okay, what do I call my basic gates? Because there may be many set of universal gates that you could use. Does that make sense for everybody? Should be easy. Now we can discuss a little bit universal sets of gates. A set S of gates, right, is universal if there exists, well, maybe I should say, yeah, if there exists a product of gates in S that yields any unitary NSU 2 to the n. That's the definition. So basically, a set of gates is universal if with those gates I can build any unitaries on the n qubits. Make sense, everybody? Now, this is a bit of a challenge. You see, it's the equivalent to the classical gates. In the classical gates case, we can build any functions from C to N to C to M. Here, we can build any unitaries on the set of qubits. Now, of course, this set is bound to be bigger, as defined like that, than the one we had for classical gates. In particular, let me give you an example. An example. C naught plus local unitaries. You see, those are entangling gates, right? C naught entangles, and local unitaries basically chooses locally where you want to be of each of the qubits. That is a universal set of gates. Now, question, how many gates are there in that set? How many? Can you try to count them?
I mean, the C naught is one, but the local
plus
unitary is
R?
SU2.
How many?
SU2, so it would be...
Yeah, how many?
It's like...
Oh, four.
No.
Sorry, three.
No, infinitely many. I don't want the generators. I want all of them. So you see, universal sets have infinitely many numbers, right? The cardinality of the set is infinite. We have infinite gates in the set. So that is kind of sad because then maybe the complexity with that, can I really in a lab do infinitely many different gates in a distinguishable way? Not really, right? So the notion of universality is pretty idealized. In practice, we talk about approximate universality when we talk about quantum gates. A set S of gates is approximately universal if there exists a product of gates in S such that one can be arbitrarily close to any U in SU to N okay. So the idea here is that, well, I want a set of gates that if I apply them many times, as many as you want, you can get arbitrarily close to any unitary.
I don't understand why that example was, I thought it was a counterexample or something.
Sorry, what? That example?
Yeah, you said that's...
That's universal indeed.
Yeah, oh, okay. No, I thought you were going to give a classical version that is, and I was confused because you can apply SU2 as many times as you want and get SU2n.
Yeah, no, this is a universal set.
Okay.
But I'm defining something else now. The reason I'm telling you, in a lab, you cannot do this. In a lab, you cannot do any unitary that you want. That's what I'm telling you.
What's the bad thing about that?
What's the bad thing? That you cannot have a universal set in the lab.
No. I mean, why can't you just get anything from the generators? If you have the generator, like the Pauli matrices and identity.
So let me give you this. Can you prepare in a lab every single vector in a Hilbert space or not? Or maybe you have experimental error and you're not able, you have boxes and you can all describe maybe a finite number or a discrete number of them. See what I mean?
Well, you have errors, but...
Then in the lab, you cannot implement the infinitely many that you need. You can implement only as much as you have resolution in the angles that you multiply the generators by and exponentiate, right?
Okay, but so you're saying that it has to be like errorless? That's the chink in the armor? I don't understand.
No. What I'm telling you is that the definition of universality, being able to do anything you want with the qubits, requires you to be able to implement the infinitely many unitaries.
Uh-huh.
No errors for that definition. Uh-huh. It's my definition, so I could tell you, well, it's my definition. What are you arguing? Maybe it's bad, maybe not, but it is a definition. The definition of universal is the equivalent to the classical one. Classically, you could do it. Classically, I told you that any function I can reproduce only by some number of gates that I can implement precisely in the lab. Now, in quantum mechanics or in quantum information, you cannot. In quantum information, to do any, you should be able to produce elements in SUN, all of them, and distinguish them. And you can't in the lab, in practice. So you may say, well, but in practice, you can get very close. Yeah, sure, that's the second definition. Make sense?
Okay.
You cannot have exact universality in a lab. That's not realistic. Make sense? Imagine that you had to design, even if you had 10,000 and not infinite, imagine that you have to design a circuit in classical logic that you need 10,000 different components to get a circuit. Imagine the cost of building a chip like that. You prefer, when you build a microchip, you basically cookie cutting components and put in the same one. For example, NANDs. I have one NAND. I put them all together and I get any function. I don't need to check a NAND and a NAND with an angle that I have infinitely many of them. See what I mean? That's what we want. We want to reduce to a small set that I can implement in a lab very well. I can be really good and very precise on one thing. But if you tell me that I have to do everything, that's going to be bad. Make sense? All right, so a set of gates is approximately universal if there exists a product of gates in S such that one can get arbitrarily close to any unitary in SU2n. Make sense? That means that I do products of the elements of S and I can get epsilon. So you tell me, I want to get epsilon close to this particular gate, to this particular operation. So, okay, yeah, apply this 10,000 times and apply this one 1,000 times and this one 3 times and you're done. And then you get epsilon close to it. Make sense? Everybody? All right, so I can give you examples. Examples of such gates. Well, Hadamard, rotation of pi over 2, and Toffoli. There you go. With these three, you can get arbitrarily close to any unitary. Can give you another one, examples. Another one is Hadamard, C naught, and rotation of pi over 4. That's also approximately universal set. You see the difference? Instead of having to implement infinitely many, I can implement maybe millions of these three that I really know how to do in my lab very well in a scale of nanoseconds, maybe even. That makes sense? So when we talk about the complexity of a quantum circuit, you better tell me what is your starting set? What is the set that you're using to build your circuit? And then complexity for finite dimension starts to make sense. Okay? That makes sense, everybody?
But if you wanted to approximate to an arbitrary, as arbitrary,
and you need many of these,
you potentially need infinite.
No, no, that's the point. You give me an epsilon, there's always a finite number of them that I need.
If I give you an
epsilon. The smaller the epsilon, of course, the more gates I need. But you see the problem, now in ULAB you don't need to implement SUN, you need to implement three gates really well, just those three, and be able to repeat them. You see how industrially that's so much better? I have three machines that are super precise, and I can keep feeding things to them. So I can build a circuit, no problem.
Is there a generic set of three that people use when they say complexity? Because people use the word complexity.
No.
There's no generic.
Well, in finite dimensions, you say, well, in finite dimensions, you can prove that all of them scale similarly, as long as your S set S is good enough. In finite dimensions, it's very easy. In infinite dimensions, though, and when people use complexity in ADS-CFT, like the number of doors of arbitrariety that opens is crazy. So you better, try to define why you're picking what you're picking. Complexity theory is complicated. In finite dimensions, it's not that complicated, but still you see the complication, right? So the thing is that in finite dimension complexity theory, people typically just find scalings, right? How things scale, the complexity scales with things, with size or different things, right? And you can prove that for any universal set of gates, that is nice enough, the scaling is the same always. So there is some meaning to that complexity that is independent of what set you get. The exact number, though, will depend, of course, on the gates. But the scaling does not. Does that make sense? Complexity theory is super cool. It's also it's super cool mathematically speaking. When we try to do physics with complexity, it becomes tricky. Because there's too much arbitrariety many times. Okay. All right. So the one thing I want to talk about is Grover's algorithm. And I have here the computer too. Ooh, with the computer, I don't know if we will play today with the computer or not, because I'm not sure I finished Grover. It depends on the discussions too. When I show you things with the computer, I will also just show you all the algebraic relations that I'm assuming trivial, or that you can do the matrix products, but I'm not. I cannot do the matrix products. So this right now probably you have to believe, right? Unless you know it from before. But I will show you, I promise. Okay. Let's do. By the way, I'm thinking of doing a obviously extremely voluntary extra session when we finish, because we have the quantum ethics session on Monday. So I don't have time for the last lecture, which is quantum energy teleportation. And I think it's cool for PSI. So we can book a time that you don't have lectures, and I can do it for you if you want. Because it's cool stuff. So nice. Grover's algorithm. All right, so the problem is a problem of searching. So let's understand what it means to search in a list, okay, of things. It's called unstructured search, the problem that we're gonna do. It's also classical, this problem, unstructured. What does that mean? Meaning that you need to find an item on a list. You know that there are the items, but you don't know which one is which. That makes sense? Somebody gives you a list, you see them. They have some information in those labels. Those labels are boxes in a way that contain some information. Maybe a number, maybe a name, information, right? Bits of information. But you can't distinguish them a priori. A search algorithm is basically, all right, I give you an algorithm to find one element in that list. For example, a classical algorithm would be check the number of every single one of them. You're allowed to query. You can do operations on them. So one way is, okay, let me check the number, read out the number. Is it the one I'm looking for? No, but the next. That's a search algorithm. That's the typical search algorithm that you do when you try to find, I don't know, socks or whatever in a pile of socks or something like that, right? It's actually the most efficient way to do it classically too. Going one by one. So let me define the problem. We have a large, in the example that I'm gonna give you, it's gonna be 8 elements, but obviously think of it as a large set of numbers, large set of items, large list of items. We're gonna call it N items, capital M. And you want to take and you want to locate one of them. Okay, so one with a particular property. All right, so for example, imagine that you have boxes. That's box 0, box 1, box 2, box 3, box 4, box 5. Then there's one you want to locate, that's box W. And of course, n minus 1 here. All right. The thing is that they contain information. So for example, they contain a number. Say that they contain a number. The number they contain, I don't know, it's like 7. 1, 12, you see, it doesn't correspond to the ordinal. This is the ordinal, okay? But the information they contain is another number, so they're not order. That makes sense, everybody? Okay. So, example for 8. 8 elements, just to write it. Let me write them like that. I have 0, 1, well, 0, I'm not going to write this, right? So I'm going to have 0, 1, comma, all the way to 7. All right, we write them in binary as we easier to work with. It's 3 qubits here. So that's going to be 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1. 1 0 0 1 0 1 1 1 0 and 1 1 1. I hopefully didn't forget any. 1 2 3 4 5 6 7 8. Perfect. Okay. So we have those items, and we want to locate one of them. I don't know. Say for example, you want the 1 0 1 1. Well, you don't know which one is which, so your best strategy classically is, okay, let's check the first one. Is it the 101? No. Then that's the second one. Is it the 101? No. And so on. Maybe there's a better way. Oh, by the way, you see that if we do that, if you say, for example, how many times do I need to try in order to find the element with a probability, say, of 99%? So if I do it many times, I want to set a number of times n that I need to check to get a certainty of 99%, for example. Well, it scales with the number of elements, obviously. You need to check about n number of times in order to make sure that you got the right one. Make sense, everybody? So classical algorithms scale with the number of items on the list. So far, so good? All right. So I'm going to give you a different way of doing it, because you see, classically, how you encode, what is your book when you prepare your list, right? How do you encode the list? Well, the list is an equal, in any case here, a list is a set of elements with equal probability, homogeneous probability of being the right one. Every element has the same probability of being, right? When you pick one at random, it has to have the same probability, all of them. No matter what W is, the probability of finding a random on the list has to be 1 over n. Make sense? That's a list. Now, we could implement this classically by creating a mixed state, right, with equal probability of each of them, right? The sum of 1 over n, all the projectors over these guys. But in quantum mechanically, we could prepare an equal superposition as well. That would also have the same probability of having all of them. So if you're preparing a quantum list, another option you have is prepare an equal superposition of all of those. Make sense, everybody? All right, so let's see what happens when we implement the list on an equal superposition and whether we can be a bit more clever about how to find one of them. Okay? All right. So the first thing that I'm going to say is the following. I'm going to have my list. It's going to be in a state S. That's going to be 1 over root n, sum over n. Of course, n equals 0 to n minus 1 of, well, I call it x here, sorry. It's better because I'm going to use n for other things. Of x, so it's the equal superposition of every possible element on the list. Make sense? That's my implementation. That's my quantum phone book, if you want. The company, instead of preparing the usual phone book, which is projectors, they prepare instead this. They have the technology to prepare. What do they need? They don't need much. Remember that this guy is just an equal superposition. You just do with Hadamard n times, right, acting on whatever you call zero in the computational basis, right? That's how you create equal superpositions with Hadamards, remember? That's what Hadamards do, okay? So yeah, there you go. You create an equal superposition of all the things that you wanna make a list of. And then our mission is, well, if the phone book comes in the quantum format, as an equal superposition of every possible element on the list, can I have an arc? I still can do the same. I can get perhaps n copies of them, right? And then ask, okay, I'm gonna randomly check the one time. Well, the probability of getting the right one is 1/n. Still the same thing. So you could repeat many times until you arrive to a threshold, and then you have high probability of having found the right one after many times, after many copies, right? You can do the classical thing to that as well. It'll be even worse than the classical one, because in the classical one, you know that if you do it n times, for sure, you're guaranteed that you get the right one in the classical one, because you can repeat over the same list. Here, you destroy it when you measure that, right? So, well, the probability of getting the right one definitely goes, if you have many copies many times, right, eventually it will converge, but it's never exactly 100% when you've done it any number of times. Make sense? You could be really unlucky in the world. So let's not do the classical thing when you prepare the quantum phone book. That would be a bad idea. Let's do something. Question.
If you have n of them and then you copy them, let's say n times, or even two times, I don't know, and you open the boxes, even quantum mechanically, you measure them.
It's a PBM?
The first copy, but I don't know how you're copying them, though. But
no, you can prepare identical states. It's not copying. It's very different.
You're preparing them.
Yeah, you know the information to prepare them.
Oh, yeah.
It's not measure and prepare.
Someone gave you the boxes, and then you said, okay, I'm going to make some copies.
Yeah, the company, no. It's the company that distributes the phone books.
Okay, and then if you have two...
But imagine that you only get one. Huh? This algorithm only requires one phone book, no more.
Yep, but if you have two, you can measure the first one. That would be of order n. And if you find them, say, okay, I'm going to take the copy that is corresponding to the first one.
No, so what you mean? Each copy will have all of them. It's a superposition of all of them. So you measure the first one, and you find that very likely is not the one you're looking for. Then you try measuring the second one with a different measurement.
Oh, okay.
See what I mean? That's the classical algorithm.
Oh, right.
Make sense? Trial and error. That's the classical algorithm. Of course, if you have this kind of phone book, first of all, nobody says that I'm giving you n copies to begin with. I'm giving you only one copy, okay? That's the resource you have. And second of all, doing classical things to the quantum one is not gonna be optimal. Maybe we can do something else. And that, we're gonna propose something to do.
Hey, but that would be still of order n, wouldn't it?
What's that?
If you had n copies though, if you had n copies.
But you don't, huh? Okay, that's a different, no Grover algorithm, something else.
Yeah, but if you had those, yeah, that would be of order n, right?
Yeah, it would be order n. Same as, it's the classical algorithm, it's exactly the same thing. Make sense? Everybody? Alrighty, so I'm gonna build something called the Oracle. So the Oracle is gonna be a unitary operation that depends on W. Remember, W is the one we want, okay, to locate on that list. So the Oracle is gonna be defined as -1 to the f of x, where f of x is equal to 0 if x is different from w, and 1 if x is equal to w. Okay, so we are, you know, we are creating a unitary that paints the right answer. See, the unitary doesn't need to know in the state where the right answer is, not measuring anything. It's acting on the state s, and it's going to paint with a minus sign. It's going to paint the right answer. So let me write it like this. For example, if in the example, say that W is 101, for example, I'm picking that this is the one I want to locate on the list, then U101 would be equal, well, I'm going to call it U5. Not to have to write everything. This is number 5. So U5 is going to be represented by this matrix, right? So I do nothing to the first 5. then I do a flip of the sign of number 5. Is it 6? Sorry, what am I doing? 5, 6, 7, no, that's wrong, sorry, my bad. It's number 5, so I have 4, right? Identity 4. Then I do minus 1 on the 5th, and then I have 3 more. So, identity 3, so. Make sense, everybody? So what this unitary does is just on the superposition, it's gonna paint with a minus sign the one that I want to find out. That doesn't seem to give us much advantage because again, probabilities are not touched with this, right? The probability of finding the right one is still the same. But I have added a property, an extra property to the one I'm looking for. Make sense? Which is changing the sign, a relative face with respect to the others. Sounds good? We call that the oracle. And that's the operation that you need to implement many times on the search. That's what we're gonna be implementing, one of the operations we're gonna see. So you need to build that. If you are searching, that's gonna be your tool. My tool is, okay, hold on, I want the 7th. Let me build this operation that acts on the 7 and changes the sign. I don't know where the 7 is, but whatever it is, it will change the sign. That makes sense? Everybody? All right, so the steps are the following. We're gonna have a step which is called amplitude amplification. All right, so chances of correct guessing are, of course, originally are, and that's gonna be, I call it SW, right? So SW, and that thing is going to be 1 over n. Agreed? Sorry. Agreed, everybody? Mm. All right. So what we're gonna do instead, we're gonna consider the two-dimensional space. I'm gonna be drawing things. Maybe I'll get the drawing on this board, not to get in the way. Because the nice thing about Grover is that we can draw it, and it's kind of nice, geometrically. Consider the two-dimensional space spanned by W and S. I'm gonna write an S prime though. W and S, of course, in general, are they, of course, in general, we know they're not orthogonal, so we cannot write an S axis and a W axis, but I can build an orthonormal set with those, okay? So what I'm gonna do first, we build an orthonormal set W S prime, okay, where S prime is Gram Smith's orthonormalization of W and S. So S prime is going to be, here you get S minus SW W, and then of course the norm of that, right? Divided by the norm of that. So all that I did is I subtract from S the projection over W, and I call that S prime. Make sense? All right, now I have an orthonormal set. So I have a space. Let me call the y-axis W and the x-axis S prime.
How are you doing the inner product? Isn't that like a measurement?
I'm not doing anything. This is math.
No.
So I want to find out what to do. I know the oracle I'm going to have to do.
But in practice, practice, if you want to know what, I don't know if you want to know, but.
You don't, so wait. Okay. All right, so here's the thing. How to put this? You know what S, the two things that you know is S and W. You know the total superposition and what you want. Make sense?
Okay, so S prime is unknown. You might want to use it mathematically, but.
S prime is unknown, but you can build an S prime. Think of it mathematically. Okay, maybe let's wait until the end and we discuss what physical one we need to, the resources that you need to employ in practice. But first, let's do the math of the protocol. But I think it becomes more clear when we finish, when we've done everything with it. What we actually require and what we don't actually require. Make sense? All right, so I built a two-dimensional space and I can draw here S. Say that, oof. Would that be okay? Oh, you're relying on my drawing skills here, so we'll see. This is S, and we call this angle theta. See? So we know that S is equal to cosine theta S prime plus sine theta W. Okay? And this sine theta is the inner product of S and W, so it's the 1 over N. Make sense, everybody? Okay, so let me just write it with sine theta. It's equal to 1 over root of n. Agreed, everyone? All right then, so steps of the protocol. Number one, apply the oracle to S. So that is U W to S. Okay, remember what the oracle does. The oracle flips the sign. So if this is, flips the sign of the W component in S. So what this is gonna do, S is also theta. And this is oracle W acting on S. Ooh, I lost it. Yeah. Agreed, everybody? This is flipping the sign of the W component. All right, so now if I were to draw step zero, say that this is a probability of finding the entry X. This is u1, x1, maybe I'll write 0, 0, 0, and so on, each one of them. So the probability is homogeneous, right? Everybody has a probability, 1 over n. Now, maybe the probability amplitudes. Maybe I'll write amplitudes. And then it's 1 over root n. OK? Now, after the first step, applying the oracle, we have now the same thing. But at some point, we have the W entry that is like that. Okay. Now, number two, apply a reflection about S. So I have my state S. I want to build a reflection operator that reflects whatever state you have here with respect to the axis that you define with S. That's very easy to build. This is, let's call it U sub S, depends on S, is twice the projector minus the identity. Of course, it's the identity by changing the sign on the direction of S. Make sense? All right, so this is a fixed, this doesn't depend on the list, it doesn't depend on the element. This is something that you can build in the lab, always, to use the same. So we build that, and then we apply that. So if we apply that, we get that's right. If we apply that, so remember, let me write it here first. The first step that I didn't write, applying the oracle, on S, we have gotten S minus 2 root n w. If now we apply the reflection over S on top of it, what do we get? Well, geometrically it's very easy. I'm going to reflect with respect to that axis, so I end up with a state okay, where this thing, right, this is 1, 2, 3 is more or less that, yeah. This is 3 theta. There was 2 thetas here, right? And I reflected over that. This is 3 theta, 4 thetas with that one, 3 thetas with the axis. But look how nice. If theta is small enough, I'm getting closer to the y-axis. See what I mean? Of course, you could overshoot, so be careful with that. We will see. But in principle, I'm closer to the axis, right? If theta is not too big, if n is large, I'm certainly closer than I was before. Make sense? Well, that's the secret. You see, that's, I could end there, right? As in, like, we are getting, but I will not. I will do the whole thing. So what I have now, after the third step, it's pretty interesting. I have reduced the probability of everything except for w. The probability amplitude of w is higher now. And because it's a unitary operation, I have to reduce the probability of everything else. Makes sense? So you see how one step of Grover, one cell, step 1 and 2 of the Grover algorithm, is amplifying the probability of finding the right one when you measure at random. OK, let's just write it, because we want to find the scaling and all. And we're running out of time. So if we apply this to, what we get is S minus 4 times root n s s w, which is, of course, 1 over root of n. That's what this is. Plus 2 root n w. So in total, I have 1 minus 4 divided by n s plus twice root n w, twice the amplitude as I had before. All right, so now what we're going to do is we start from, this is, I'm going to write the circuit, right? So the circuit, the cell that I'm going to apply many times. The circuit is that, so you start at 0, and then what you do, this line represents all the qubits, okay? So I have many qubits, as many as the log of the number of elements on the list that I want, log 2. Make sense? So the first thing, I prepare the phone book. This is what the company does for me, the phone book company. That's the Hadamard on the computational state 0000000000. All right? And then we have a, let me put it in a box, and I'm going to say what's inside of the box. We apply the oracle of the entry that we want to locate in the list. That's the oracle. And the next thing we do is apply twice projector minus identity, which is the reflector. We call this the two things, the amplitude amplification gate, or you can call it the diffuser. People actually call it diffuser a lot in quantum info. So let's call it diffuser. Diffuser, and you apply this box some times. We will discuss how many times now, and then in the end you measure. So the idea is that you do this many times, this box is going to be repeated many times, to amplify the probability as much as you can, and then when it's the closest possible to 1 of finding W, you measure. So randomly measuring the state, you're going to find the one you want. Make sense?
Hey, what have you written?
Diffuser.
Oh, diffuser.
Yeah, it's a name is given in quantum info for that gate. I guess it's a diffuser in the sense that it's diffusing the probability distribution, but whatever. I prefer amplitude amplification because it's certainly it depends what you focus on to name it.
Okay, so.
I haven't finished yet, huh? Okay.
Yeah, no, but SUW, when you applied that to S, you wrote that and you said, oh, the amplitude is twice now.
Yeah.
But I think you were comparing this with ket s is equal to cosine theta s prime plus sine theta w. But here on the right hand side.
So hold on.
could ask.
No, the amplitude is not twice here. I never said the amplitude is twice. Twice is only here, yeah.
But here you have a ket s. If you want to compare this with the theta, that should be ket s prime.
No, you're right. It's not exactly twice as much. I agree. You need to subtract. Yeah, you're right. Forget about it. But it's clear. I said twice I was talking too much. It's clear that it's closer to W, no? Look at the picture.
Yeah, I mean,
you can compare it. You can write now S. Okay, for writing it in terms of the S prime, what you need to do is write S now as a superposition of is S prime plus W, right? Plus one of the W. So it's even more. It's kind of cool, right? So let's see. This S is S prime plus W. Well, not quite that.
Cosine,
no, you need to be a bit more careful because we have it.
You said cosine theta S prime plus sine theta.
That's right. So you need the cosine theta, and it depends on the number of times that you apply that. So yeah, for now, let's say the state is this. And for now, even though I'm telling you,
it is bigger.
Don't care how bigger now. We're gonna compute exactly. I mean, it's clear that it's getting bigger, right?
Yeah, okay.
I actually want this angle. What I'm going to do is make this angle as close to pi over 2 as possible.
So well, it's not 3 theta then.
This is 3 theta. This angle is 3 theta, indeed.
But
look at the reflection. Look what I've done. I've reflected over here.
The reflection is all right, but then you said after the reflection is 3. Then after applying.
No, I'm doing this. This picture is exactly what I've done then mathematically.
Yeah, but the mathematically it's not.
It is 3 theta, yes.
Is
yeah. If you compute it, it's 3 theta. Well, look at that. The math is, look at the picture. All that I'm doing is a reflection over S. If the angle is 2 theta here, it's going to be another 2 theta on the other side. So it's 3 theta to the axis.
Right. Okay.
You see what I mean? So I know the result is right. I don't need to do it. I would do it because remember, the cosine and the sine are 1 over root, and you can substitute, you would get that. I promise. Okay, so what we have now is let's estimate how many times do I need to do this in order to get as close as possible to W. Make sense, everybody? All right, so I have US, UW, N times. Acting on S. And I know, look how I'm going to write it. I know the result without doing that. That was for the sake of having it. But I know for a fact that what I have is the cosine of 2m plus 1 theta S prime plus the sine of 2m plus 1 theta W, because that's what I'm doing geometrically. So that's actually very nice. That means that, of course, I want the probability to be the closest to 1. So I want to find that 2n plus 1 theta is equal to pi over 2. That would give me perfection. That would give me probability 1 of finding W when I measure the state. OK, when does that happen? All right, so we solve for n. So n is equal to pi over 4 arcsine of 1 over root n, because theta is the sine of theta is 1 over root n, minus 1 half. Okay? So that means when n is much larger than 1 for very, very long lists, in general, for small lists, you're going to overshoot very likely. You get the closest possible, and then you will overshoot for a very few number. But if it's very few elements, don't spend your quantum resources on a list of 7 elements. You want to have lists that are huge, right? So when n is larger than 1, much larger than 1, then n goes like pi square root of n divided by 4. So it goes like order root of n. And that's the key. That's the advantage that this algorithm has over the classical one. You only need to apply the oracle and diffuser step square root n times. And then one measurement. Does that make sense? That is the advantage that the algorithm has. You can ask, yeah, because it will take a while for it to work.
OK, so I saw something about how Uber's algorithm offers no quantum at the
event. That's new. That was 2 days ago.
2 days ago.
That's right. Yeah, I haven't read the paper yet, so I have to see it. But at least compare, it's clear that at least compared to the search element by element, it's a square root of n. Maybe what they found is a clever way of classically getting same scaling. Then may not. But at least you can see in principle how you can get a quantum algorithm that does something better than one classical algorithm. It was known at the very least until 3 days ago that this is, and it's actually kind of cool because you can prove that this guy will never be, this is the optimal when you do quantum algorithms. There's no better optimal quantum algorithm. And that tells you something about complexity in quantum problems, but we can discuss it. Let me just do this quickly, if that's fine. So here, I'm defining my basis and all. You see, these are the 42 qubits and whatever. These are the gates that we talked about. I'm going to play with rotations. I'm going to show you that, right, I don't care. Okay, here, let's do Grover, okay? If we do Grover, we know the optimal is this function. I don't know whether it's 1 over 2 and so on. This is the optimal number of times that you need to repeat the algorithm, okay? For AI, that's why it gives you a number, because it's of 8 qubits. So we know that for 8 qubits, 8 elements, 3 qubits. We know that the number of times is going to be about 2. You see? All right, so let's do it. Let's do search here. So let me initialize this. That's the initial state, right? Before preparing that's what the company, the phone book company, those are the trees that the phone book company has cut. But, yeah.
Put 1 over 0.67 means that you have to find the first integer, right?
So it could be either 2, it's looking like 2 is going to be better. You're going to overshoot, but not by a lot.
Yeah, but if you want to get it perfectly, you might have to do what?
Many rotate. I don't care about getting perfectly. We'll see. We'll see. All right, so this is the tree, right, that is chopped and is sent to the phone book company. Now, the phone book company prepares the tensor product of the three Hadamards and applies it to the state, and we get an equal superposition. Make sense? Everybody? 1 over square root 8 for each of them. All right, we build, we know the winner. The winner is going to be this, right? That's the state we want. Let's say that the state that we want is number 7, or number 6, rather, because we start counting from 0. And we build the oracle, and the oracle is as simple as that. It's the identity but flipping sign for the second last entry. Let me build now. What is S here? I don't have an S. The oracle S is the state, right, as we have. So the oracle acting on the state, all that it does is flipping the sign. Oh, I have the solution, which is kind of sad. I like that you see them appear. Right? The oracle, all that it does is flipping the sign of the one you want. Now, of course, we build the diffuser. We build the rotation, the reflection over S, and that's the reflection over S. And now we are prepared to apply Grover. I define this function. Oh, no. I really don't want the solutions to be there. Let's apply it 0 times first. Right? See? So this function, this applies Grover. This function applies Grover I times. Maybe I should call it I times. So let's do 0. So for 0, the probability distribution is homogeneous, as we know. And then for 1, well, look at that. Great amplification of number 6, which is what you want. And if you do it 2, it's better. That's it. If you do more, you're going to overshoot, and the probability is going to be. In fact, if you keep doing it, look what happens. Look, and then, oh, so sad. So you only do it twice to get close to the optimal. Make sense, everybody? Example with 4 qubits. This is kind of cool. So with 4 qubits, I don't have 4 qubits here. With 4 qubits, it's that thing. Okay, it doesn't matter. So let me just plot this. Why do I have 2 to the n? Ah, right, because the number of qubits, yeah, of course. Let's see for what point, for how many numbers, not number of qubits. This is a plot that tells you how many times you have to do it, but it's a plot of the square root of n thing that we found, right? How many times you have to repeat the algorithm in order in order to be the closest possible, the optimal one. There is a point where this thing is exactly one. And there is a point where this thing is exactly three. Let me solve, oh, I already have it here. Sure. So when x is equal to four, when the number of elements you're searching over is four, only one step gives you the exact, gives you probability one for them. And when the number is 20, well, very close, you get something very close to three times. Make sense? All right, you get really close. So these are cases where Grover is extremely accurate, as an infinitely accurate in the first case, and very accurate in the second for integers. Make sense? Can I give you something wild, and then we go? This is wild to think about. This is wild. This is something falsifiable and wild. Imagine that there is a problem, which is non-trivial, which is I want to encode information, and I want to encode information in a way that is easy to search. If I were to encode information in a way that's easy to search, imagine that I'm building, you know, a storage of information, a hard drive or whatever. And I have to pick how many different things I want to store. Instead of ones and zeros, I want maybe three, four things, five things. Per unit of information is one out of n, right? Let's say that n is four. So if you want to optimize, when you want to search the components to make them, if you want to optimize using Grover, you pick four. You encode with four because it's very easy. I get equal superpositions, then I pick four. I pick one of them with only one application of Grover. Right, make sense? And if I have to store information with 20 ingredients, if I want to store information but I need more ingredients for some reason, well, better pick 20, right? Because it's also very close to three Grover, if what you have is Grover. Make sense? There's some wild comment that people hear again. We have abandoned science for a second. The wild comment is, well, we know it is weird because there's something that is not really easy to explain. In nature, there's one thing that encodes information in fours and in 20s. Units. You know what that is?
420.
What's that?
Sorry?
Did you say the answer?
It's 420. Just a joke.
What's that?
He's just saying some joke.
Ah, I see. Sorry. Yeah. Do you know anything in the universe that encodes information using four different things to encode information? And then 20. Yeah. What is it?
DNA.
And amino acids for proteins. It's something of a mystery in biology why we encode with four, because you can build DNA strands with eight nitrogen bases, no problem. With five, no problem. In the lab, you do have them. And you can mean proteins with more than 20 amino acids. Yet life only uses four for nitrogen bases and 20 for amino acids. So it's a coincidence, of course. But if you were to actually pick from many of those around you, perhaps if you have the ability to prepare a phone book in a quantum way and use Grover, that would be what you would choose. That's the energetically most favorable if what you have is Grover. Again, sci-fi. This is falsifiable. You can actually probably do investigations. Nobody would because nobody would take it seriously. But there you go, right?
So it's falsifiable, so it's not sci-fi.
Yeah, it's also falsifiable that I can't fly, but I don't see many scientists trying to test. You know what I mean? In that sense,
yeah.
It's kind of a very wild thing. But it's kind of cool to look. You see, biology has two mysteries that physics could solve. Well, I would say infinitely many, but biology has two. The most basic biology would have two mysteries. One is that, why 4 and why 20? In all life that we know of, it's not humans or anything. When life started, they picked that for some reason. So it could be random. We only have one Earth and one life appearing. It could be, why not? But you see, life probably didn't start in one point on Earth. Maybe it started in several, I would imagine, right? Maybe it started in one, maybe it started in several. And yet, all life shares that. There's something else that all life shares, which is chirality. As in, like, our amino acids have only one chirality. You have two isomers, which have chirality, left-handed versus right-handed molecules, and we only use one kind. Same for sugars. In fact, if you eat all the others, you will not digest them, you will not incorporate them, they can actually cause problems because they start bonding with things that you cannot process or eliminate or anything. So, why do we use right-handed amino acids instead of left-handed amino acids? When you create them in the lab, you get both 50-50. You see what I mean? And why life only uses one of them? Again, you could conclude life started only in one point. Only in one, not in several places at the same time. That would explain it, right? That would make, if you make a random choice, that random choice is the one that's going to survive. But it's so difficult to believe, right? I don't know, whatever. People looked at that with the weak interaction. The weak interaction is the only one that distinguishes chirality. And it turns out that, yeah, sure, the chirality we use in life is more stable. It's more likely to happen. But more likely to happen, weak interaction we're talking about versus electromagnetic. Like, yeah, it's negligible. In the lab, they didn't see it. You see what I mean? When they prepare, when you synthesize proteins in the lab, the chirality you get both at the, with the same probability, even though right-handed is more stable for the amino acids because of the weak interaction. Mainly because your biology lab is not a high-energy physics lab. You're not going to be able to resolve that amount of energy. That makes sense? Anyway, a couple of mysteries. Chirality, why one? Number of amino acids, why one? There's no explanation for that, but there you go. It's optimal for Grover. For the simplest Grover, one and three. Well, two could be as well, but two maybe is too simple. Right? One is two, and two maybe is very far from an integer. I actually don't know. Yeah, it's 0.4, right? Three is closer to an integer. There you go. So why not? Anyway, whatever. Sorry. End of the wild fun. Hopefully fun. Diversion.